Hi, I'm Amy Goodman. This year, Democracy Now! Turns 25 years old. That's right, 25 years of bringing you the voices and stories you won't hear in the corporate media. Democracy Now! Has always refused to take government or corporate funding because nothing is more important to us than our editorial independence. Nothing is more important to us than telling you the truth. But that means we rely on you, our audience, for support. Please visit democracynow.org right now and make your $25 contribution in honor of our 25th anniversary and help us stay on air for another 25 years and then another 25 after that. Thank you so much. And remember, wearing a mask is an act of love. Wearing two is even better. From New York, this is Democracy Now!
The police know the criminal operation of the Black Muslim movement because they have thoroughly infiltrated it.
The FBI and New York police are facing new calls to finally open their records on Malcolm X's assassination 56 years ago in the Audubon Ballroom in Harlem. This comes after the release of a deathbed confession of a former undercover New York police officer who admitted to being part of a police and FBI conspiracy targeting Malcolm X. The officer was there when Malcolm was killed. We'll speak to a cousin of the late officer, as well as Malcolm's daughter, Ilyasa Shabazz.
Any evidence that provides greater insight into the truth behind that terrible tragedy should be thoroughly investigated.
We'll also speak to civil rights attorney Ben Crump on the push to reopen the probe into Malcolm X's assassination, as well as the latest on the police killings of George Floyd, Daniel Prude, and Breonna Taylor. All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The Quarantine Report. I'm Amy Goodman. U.S. Air Force fighter jets bombed buildings in eastern Syria Thursday, with the Pentagon claiming it successfully targeted Iranian-backed militant groups. Iranian media said the airstrikes killed 17 fighters. The Pentagon called the assault a response to recent rocket attacks on U.S. forces in northern Iraq. Those attacks came more than a year after Iraq's parliament voted to expel U.S. troops, an order that's been ignored by both the Trump and Biden administrations. Thursday's assault is the first known military action ordered by President Biden. California Congressmember Ro Khanna condemned the attack, saying, quote, "There is absolutely no justification for a president to authorize a military strike that's not in self-defense against an imminent threat without congressional authorization. We need to extricate from the Middle East, not escalate," he said. President Biden spoke with Saudi Arabia's King Salman Thursday as the U.S. prepares to release an intelligence report on the 2018 murder of Washington Post columnist and Saudi dissident Jamal Khashoggi. A White House readout of the call says Biden reaffirmed the U.S. commitment to joint defense against, quote, Iranian-aligned groups, as well as the effort to end the war on Yemen and the importance of human rights, commending the recent release of prominent women's rights activist Lujain Al-Hathloul. The readout, however, does not mention Jamal Khashoggi or Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman, who is widely thought to be responsible for Khashoggi's assassination. Brazil's COVID-19 death toll has passed a quarter million, the second highest toll in the world after the United States, and about 10% of all coronavirus deaths worldwide. Brazil has vaccinated just 3.6% of its population after a disastrous rollout led by far-right President Jair Bolsonaro, a COVID-19 denier who said he personally might not get vaccinated. Meanwhile, the World Health Organization warned in a new report that millions of COVID-19 survivors continue to suffer debilitating and lingering symptoms after their initial bout of the disease, with major social, health and economic consequences. Dr. Hans Kluge is the WHO's regional director for Europe.
The burden is real, and it is significant. About 1 in 10 COVID-19 sufferers remain unwell after 12 weeks, and many for much longer.
The World Health Organization's report on so-called long COVID was led by Professor Martin McKee of the London School of Hygiene and Tropical Medicine.
Those suffering from it describe a varying combination of overlapping symptoms: chest pain, muscle pain, fatigue, shortness of breath, and what patients describe as brain fog, among many, many others.
The United States recorded another 77,000 coronavirus cases and 2,400 COVID-19 deaths Thursday. A seven-day average of new infections has begun to tick up again after a sharp fall from January's peak. In Washington, D.C., President Biden held an event marking 50 million vaccinations under his administration.
This is not a time to relax. We must keep washing our hands, stay socially distanced, and for God's sake, wear a mask.
The House of Representatives holds a historic vote today on President Biden's coronavirus relief bill, with majority Democrats expected to approve the $1.9 trillion package. Meanwhile, the Senate's parliamentarian has advised Democrats against including a boost in the minimum wage to $15 an hour federally as part of the stimulus bill, saying such a move is prohibited by Senate rules. Progressive Democrats are calling on the Senate's presiding officer, Vice President Kamala Harris, to disregard the advice of the unelected parliamentarian in order to fulfill her campaign promise to more than double the minimum wage. Since 2009, the federal minimum wage has remained at $7.25 an hour and just $2.13 an hour for millions of workers who receive tips. An estimated 32 million people would benefit from a minimum wage increase. The acting chief of the Capitol Police Department warned a House panel Thursday, pro-Trump extremists who attack Congress on January 6 are plotting more violence. Chief Yogananda Pittman said a fortified security perimeter surrounding the Capitol should remain in place based on credible threats.
We know that members of the militia groups that were present on January 6 have stated their desires that they want to blow up the Capitol and kill as many members as possible with a direct nexus to the State of the Union.
In Nigeria, up to 300 schoolgirls are missing after gunmen raided a boarding school in the northwestern state of Zamfara. The exact number of abducted children and other details remain unclear in the attack, which comes 1 week after a raid on a school in north-central Nigeria, where one student was killed and 42 people kidnapped and are still being held hostage. The U.S. House has passed landmark legislation that amends the 1964 Civil Rights Act to include sexual orientation and gender identity as protected groups. The Equality Act extends discrimination protections for LGBTQ people at the workplace, in housing, education, among other areas. This is Democratic Congressmember Mondaire Jones of New York, who's among the first Black openly gay men to be elected to Congress, speaking on the House floor Thursday.
To grow up poor, Black, and gay is to not see yourself anywhere. It is also to feel completely unseen, as so many people around you invalidate your very existence. Today, we send a powerful message to millions of LGBTQ people around the country and indeed around the world that they are seen, that they are valued, that their lives are worthy of being protected.
The bill is expected to face an uphill battle in the Senate, where Republicans largely oppose the Equality Act. Meanwhile, Republican Senator Rand Paul's facing backlash over his transphobic attacks against Rachel Levine during her historic confirmation hearing for Assistant Health and Human Services Secretary. On Thursday, Senator Paul repeatedly compared hormone therapy and transition surgery for trans people with genital mutilation. Levine responded, quote, "Transgender medicine is a very complex and nuanced field with robust research and standards of care," unquote. If appointed, Levine would be the first out trans official to be confirmed by the Senate. This comes as far-right Republican Congressmember Marjorie Taylor Greene is being condemned for hanging a poster outside her office that reads, quote, "There are two genders, male and female, trust the science. Green displayed the poster after Democratic Congresswoman Marie Newman of Illinois raised a transgender pride flag outside her office, which is directly across from Green's. Newman's daughter is transgender. A warning to our viewers, the next two stories contain descriptions of sexual harassment and violence. In New York, a former top aide to Governor Andrew Cuomo is accusing him of sexual harassment and intimidation. In an essay published in Medium, Lindsay Boylan says the governor went out of his way to touch her lower back, arms and legs and accuses him of kissing her during a one-on-one meeting. Boylan first made the accusations public in a Twitter thread back in December, where she wrote, quote, "Yes, New York Governor Cuomo sexually harassed me for years. Many saw it and watched," she said. Boylan is currently running for Manhattan borough president. Meanwhile, Governor Cuomo faces a probe by the FBI and a federal prosecutor over his administration's cover-up of thousands of COVID deaths in nursing homes. And he's being accused of bullying by New York Assemblymember Ron Kim, who says Cuomo called him at his home and threatened to destroy him. In Michigan, former U.S. Olympic gymnastics coach John Gettert died by suicide Thursday, moments after he was charged with sexual assault and human trafficking. In addition to two charges of sexual assault against children, Gettert was accused of enabling former Olympic team physician and convicted serial rapist and child sexual abuser Dr. Larry Nassar. Nassar survivor Sarah Klein was just 8 years old when she began training in Gettert's gym. On Thursday, she said, quote, "He tortured and abused little girls, myself included, for more than 30 years and was able to cheat justice." And Georgia state Republicans have introduced sweeping voter suppression legislation, which would strictly limit eligibility criteria for absentee ballots, as well as require witness signatures and proof of voter ID for mail-in ballots. The measure also bars advance voting on Sundays, which black churches use as part of their get-out-the-vote efforts, known as the Souls to the Polls. Georgia flipped blue in both the 2020 presidential race and the two Senate runoffs, largely thanks to black voters and the work of black organizers. This is AME Church Bishop Reginald Thomas Jackson speaking at a Fair Fight Action virtual hearing on the bill.
Let's just be honest. This bill is racist. This legislation is submitted only because Republicans lost, because blacks exercised their right to vote and turned out in huge numbers.
And those are some of the headlines. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The Quarantine Report. I'm Amy Goodman. A warning to our audience, our first segment today contains graphic descriptions of police violence. The Democratic-led House of Representatives is expected to vote next week on a sweeping police reform bill that would ban chokeholds, prohibit federal no-knock warrants, establish a national police misconduct registry, and other measures. The bill is called the George Floyd Justice in Policing Act of 2021, named after the African-American man who was killed last year by a white Minneapolis police officer who pressed his knee into Floyd's neck for nearly 9 minutes. Video of the incident sparked international protests. This comes as the trial of the officer Derek Chauvin, who's been out on bail, begins March 8th. Meanwhile, in Rochester, New York, protests broke out this week after a grand jury decided not to file charges against the Rochester police officers involved in the death of Daniel Prude. The black father died last March from asphyxiation while experiencing a mental health crisis. Officers handcuffed him while he was naked, put a hood over his head in the freezing cold, then pushed his face into the ground for 2 minutes while kneeling on his back. Prude's brother had called the police while he was experiencing a mental health crisis. Meanwhile, in Kentucky, the state Senate unanimously passed a bill on Thursday to ban some no-knock police warrants. This comes nearly a year after 26-year-old Breonna Taylor was shot to death in her own Louisville home by plainclothes officers serving a no-knock warrant. And in Georgia, the mother of Ahmaud Arbery has filed a multi-million-dollar civil lawsuit against the white men who chased down and shot to death her 25-year-old son while he was out for a jog. The lawsuit also accuses law enforcement officials and local prosecutors of attempting to cover up evidence about the killing. Tuesday marked the first anniversary of Arbery's murder. We begin today's show with one of the nation's leading civil rights attorneys, Benjamin Crump. He's represented the families of George Floyd, Daniel Prude, Ahmaud Arbery, and many other victims of police violence. Welcome back to Democracy Now! It's great to have you with us. Let's begin with this legislation that's going to be on the House of Representatives next week to be voted on. Can you talk about this George Floyd bill?
Yes, ma'am. Thank you so much for having me, Amy, and talking about these important historical matters that will hopefully change policing in America, change the culture of policing in America. We need systematic reform. And the George Floyd Justice and Accountability Policing Act is so crucial. Last year, it passed the House of Representatives, but Mitch McConnell, the leader of the Senate at the time, refused to bring it to the floor. And so it is our hope that it will pass the House of Representatives again next week, which we fully anticipate on Thursday. And then it will go to the United States Senate, where we anticipate it may be a very partisan vote, that Vice President Kamala Harris may have to be the deciding vote that gets it passed the United States Senate. And then the expectation is for President Joe Biden to sign this historic piece of legislation within his first 100 days of his administration. And that is crucial, Amy, because aside from banning chokeholds and no-knock warrants, it also speaks to having a national database of these police who engage in this excessive use of force and misconduct, so they can't simply be exposed for killing a black person or brutalizing a person of color and then go down the street in the next city and get another job, as was the case with Tamir Rice, the 12-year-old kid who was killed on the playground. The officer that killed him just 3 months prior had been terminated from another police department where they said he was unfit to be a police officer. And then he got a job in Cleveland. Within 2 weeks, he then killed this little 12-year-old child playing on the playground by himself. And that's why we need this bill. And also, it speaks to qualified immunity that the Supreme Court put forth, giving police officers a way to get out of jail pass when they kill especially a marginalized person of color. And Graham v. Conner and Gardner v. Tennessee, where literally all the police has to do is say three little words and they will be justified in whatever way they kill us. They say, "I felt fear. I felt threatened." And the Supreme Court said, "Well, you can't Monday morning quarterback the police. You were not there. You don't know what their subjective fear was, but we have video. We have objective evidence saying that this was an excessive use of force when you shoot yet again another black man in the back running away from you. How could you say that you were in fear of your life?" We got example of example, whether it's Terrence Crutcher walking away with his hands up, whether it's Jacob Blake Jr. Walking away, trying to get away from the police, whether it's Laquan McDonald. I mean, in all these situations, the police tried to say they were in fear of their life, even though the black people were running away from them when they killed us. So that's why we have to pass this legislation to have systematic reform and a change in culture so we can truly say that the courts respect Black Lives Matter.
Ben Crump, I wanted to ask you also about the new federal grand jury that's been impaneled in Minneapolis, and the Justice Department has called new witnesses as part of its investigation into Derek Chauvin, the former police officer who goes on trial next month on the murder charge of George Floyd. The significance of this, and could this lead to more charges filed against Chauvin?
We certainly expect the federal government to bring charges against Officer Derek Chauvin in violation of the civil rights of George Floyd, who he tortured to death by putting his knee on his neck for 8 minutes and 46 seconds. And as we all know, it was captured on video with citizens practically begging Officer Chauvin to take his knee off his neck while George Floyd said, "I can't breathe," for 28 times. And so normally the federal government and most of these Black Lives Matter police killings, they say that there is not enough evidence for them to bring federal charges because it's such a high bar to have to prove that there was a violation of civil rights, because they say that they can't infer what was in the mind of the police officer. Well, here we know Derek Chauvin had ample time to take his knee off his neck, and when asked by other officers that were there also restraining George Floyd, we are concerned about him, maybe we should turn him over, his words were, "No, we will keep him like this." That tells us his mindset that he intended to continue to punish George Floyd. And for what reason? We saw in the video, George Floyd was very compliant with the police officers. They did not have to torture this human being to death.
I wanted to ask you, Ben Crump, about another case that you're involved with, and that's the case of Daniel Prude, this horrific killing almost a year ago in Rochester. Major protests this week because a grand jury refused to charge any of the officers involved. Daniel Prude's daughter, Tashira Prude, appeared on CNN in September calling for the Rochester officers involved in the killing to be fired and charged with murder. This is what she said.
"I would like to see them be fired and charged with murder. There's video footage of these people suffocating my father. My father was murdered by these police officers. There's no reason why they should be on a paid suspension. They should be arrested and they should be tried as the killers that they are."
And so now this grand jury has refused to indict, and despite calls for the charges to be brought by New York's Attorney General Letitia James, whose office led the investigation. She said most recently, "Daniel Prude was in the throes of a mental health crisis, and what he needed was compassion, care, and help from trained professionals. Tragically, he received none of those things." Can you talk about the refusal to indict?
Yes, it's regrettable that many times, because the grand jury proceedings are secret, we don't know what evidence was offered by the prosecutor to the jurors in making their determination. We must remember in Breonna Taylor's case and Michael Brown in Ferguson, Missouri case, one of the rare instances where we saw the inner workings of the grand jury. We saw that the prosecutors put forth a very weak case. And when you put forth a weak case to get a prosecution, then you won't get the grand jury to decide. Amy, it has been said that a prosecutor can indict a ham sandwich because 99.999% of the time when a prosecutor wants an indictment, a prosecutor gets an indictment. Oftentimes, prosecutors, because they have this symbiotic relationship with law enforcement, will give greater consideration to police officers than the unknown African-American or Hispanic citizens that they have no relationship with when they go in that grand jury proceeding. We saw it so many times throughout the country. It is historical where they will try to wash the blood off their hands by saying, "Well, we presented to the grand jury and the grand jury found no probable cause." Well, we don't buy that. We know that's part of the intellectual justification of discrimination that leads to the legalized genocide of black people in America. And that's why we have to have systemic reform to change the entire culture of criminal justice in America. As we said after Michael Brown grand jury decision was announced, the whole system needs to be indicted. Other than that, they will continue to kill black people with impunity.
Wanda Cooper Jones, the mother of Ahmaud Arbery, who you know well, spoke to Waynesboro, Georgia's TV station WRDW on the first anniversary of her son's killing this week.
I wouldn't say that I've healed much. I've learned how to take day by day, sometimes hour by hour. When I pray and I stand on my, faith, and God will get me through.
What's been the hardest part?
To just imagining life without Ahmaud. I'm very confident that we will get justice, but what's so fearful is that after justice, Ahmaud won't be with me.
Can you talk about the substance of this lawsuit as we wrap up this segment of the show?
I can't, Amy. This lawsuit was filed by our legal team to be able to make sure that this murderous father and son duo of Travis and Gregory McMichael will be held accountable. But also, Amy, Attorney Lee Merritt, Attorney Chris Stewart, and us, we want to make certain that the government officials, like the district attorney and the police department there in Brunswick, who seem to have condoned at best and in ways participated or conspired to allow these murders to evade justice. Remember, Amy, it took 10 months for them to just be arrested. You know, we had to get the video released because even though the police saw the video of Ahmaud Arbery being lynched for jogging while black on the first day, they took the word of the lynch mob who said it was self-defense. It wasn't until we, the people who saw the video, when they finally arrested these murderers after 10 months of them sleeping in peace in their bed. And that's why we continue to argue, whether it's in the Malcolm X case or it's in Breonna Taylor, Ahmaud Arbery, Jacob Blake Jr., we argue transparency, transparency, transparency. We won't let you kill our leaders and our people and then sweep it under the rug and say that their lives didn't matter. Ahmaud Arbery life matters. Breonna Taylor life matters. George Floyd life matters. Daniel Prude life matters. And Malcolm X, who I argue was the personification of Black Lives Matter, his life matters. And that's why we're demanding transparency plus accountability. That's the only way we get to justice.
Which brings us to our next segment. Benjamin Crump, we want to ask you to stay with us. Civil rights attorney representing the families of George Floyd, Breonna Taylor, Daniel Prude, the family of Ahmaud Arbery. In all of these cases, Taylor and Prude and Floyd, the victims of police violence. He's staying with us after this short break, after new calls to reopen the probe of Malcolm X's assassination following the release of a deathbed confession of a former undercover New York police officer. We'll be speaking with the officer's cousin. The officer admitted to being at the scene of Malcolm X's assassination, working undercover in a FBI police conspiracy targeting Malcolm. Stay with us.
In this world, there are many stepping stones, 'cause man, many grown. Make him want to walk alone in search for a friendly home. Oh, but my friend, it's not right on top of the hill, but it shines long as it will. Letting the world see
Fight on the Hill by Mary Clayton. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The Quarantine Report. I'm Amy Goodman. The FBI and New York police departments are facing new calls to finally open their records related to the assassination of Malcolm X, shot dead 56 years ago at the Audubon Ballroom in Harlem, February 21st, 1965. This comes after the release of a deathbed confession of a former undercover New York police officer who admitted to being part of a broad New York police and FBI conspiracy targeting Malcolm. In the confession, the former officer, Raymond Wood, who died last year, admitted he entrapped two members of Malcolm's security team in another crime, a plot to blow up the Statue of Liberty, just days before the assassination. On Saturday, Ray Wood's cousin, Reggie Wood, read the letter at a news conference at the Shabazz Center in Harlem.
It was my assignment to draw the two men into a felonious federal crime so that they could be arrested by the FBI and kept away from managing Malcolm X's Audubon Ballroom door security on February 21st, 1965.
In his letter, Raymond Wood also revealed he was inside the Audubon Ballroom at the time of Malcolm's assassination. At least one other undercover New York police officer, Gene Roberts, was also inside after infiltrating the security team of the Organization of Afro-American Unity, the group Malcolm founded after leaving the Nation of Islam. Both officers, Wood and Roberts, were part of the Bureau of Special Services and Investigations, or BOSSE, a secretive political intelligence unit of the NYPD nicknamed the Red Squad. Following Malcolm's assassination, police arrested three members of the Nation of Islam for his murder. But questions about the guilt of the men have lingered for decades. In his letter, Raymond Wood openly says one of the men, Thomas Johnson, was innocent and was arrested to, quote, protect my cover and the secrets of the FBI and the NYPD, unquote. Ray Wood's letter echoes claims in recent books by Manning Marable and Les Payne that some of Malcolm's actual assassins were never charged. In a moment, we'll be joined by Raymond Wood's cousin, Reggie Wood, who released his deathbed confession. But first, I want to turn to the words of Malcolm X himself, speaking after his home in Queens was firebombed just a week before his assassination, February 14th, 1965.
My house was bombed. It was bombed by the black Muslim movement upon the orders of Elijah Muhammad. Now, they had come around to, they had planned to do it from the front and the back so that I couldn't get out. They covered the front completely, the front door. Then they had come to the back, but instead of getting in directly in the back of the house and throwing it this way, they stood at a 45-degree angle and tossed it at the window so it glanced and went onto the ground. And the fire hit the window, and it woke up my second oldest baby. But the fire burned on the outside of the house. But had that one gone through that window, it would have fallen on a 6-year-old girl, a 4-year-old girl, and a 2-year-old girl. And I'm going to tell you, if it had done it, I'd taken my rifle and gone after anybody in sight. I would not wait. And I say that because of this. The police know the criminal operation of the black Muslim movement because they have thoroughly infiltrated it.
Those are the words of Malcolm X right before his assassination, right after his home was firebombed in February of 1965. Just days later, he was shot seconds after he took the stage at the Audubon Ballroom. We're joined now by Reggie Wood, the cousin of Raymond Wood, author of the new book, The Ray Wood Story, Confessions of a Black NYPD Cop in the Assassination of Malcolm X. Still with us, civil rights attorney Ben Crump, who attended that news conference with Reggie Wood at the Audubon Ballroom, now the Shabazz Center, where Malcolm X was assassinated 56 years ago. Reggie, thank you so much for joining us. You read parts of the letter this weekend. Talk about your cousin, Ray Wood, and what you understand happened, the conspiracy he alleges that he was a part of by the FBI and the New York Police Department to assassinate Malcolm X.
Good morning. Thank you for having me. Ray was a complicated man. I think based on his past experiences. He lived with a lot of fear and caution on a daily basis, which he instilled in me over the past 10 years. But Ray was a person that lived as a he lived as a very quiet and reserved person because of what he had experienced. He witnessed some horrible things firsthand and also realized that he was a part of it after the fact. And so therefore, Ray was told by his handlers that not to repeat anything that he had seen or heard, or he would join Malcolm. Therefore, for 46 years, Ray separated himself from the family and in fear that he would put us in danger. Now, Ray lived alone many years, and he finally, in his final years, when he realized that he was his cancer was reoccurring, he wanted to reconnect with family because he didn't want to die alone. So I volunteered to move him to Florida so that my wife and I could take care of him and get him back and forth to his cancer treatments and things of that nature. And therefore, he trusted me enough to reveal this information and ask me not to say anything until he passed away, but at the same time, not to allow him to take it to his grave.
You write in your book, Reggie Wood, he'd spent years living in relative obscurity, wanting to ensure the cops wouldn't preemptively act to silence him. He also feared retribution from society, especially the black community. Ray was ashamed of what he'd been a part of and felt he'd betrayed his own people. Due to his lugubrious feelings about his actions and fear for what might be done to him in retaliation, this 2015 article deeply impacted Ray, and he's talking about this news coverage from February. He was talking about the article by Garrett Felber in The Guardian that really laid out your cousin's seminal involvement here and the FBI police involvement in the assassination.
Yes, That book really details everything that happened. I felt that after consulting with Mr. Crump, I was looking for the best way to put this information out there. I wasn't sure if it was safe to turn it over to authorities. Therefore, I just wrote everything that Ray told me into this memoir and made it available to the world so that everyone would see it and hear it at the same time. And I think that's the best way to do it. It's a load off of my back because I'm no longer in fear of the government trying to quiet me as well.
I want to turn to news coverage from February 1965 about the police orchestrated plot to blow up the Statue of Liberty. This was just days before Malcolm X's assassination. This might be news to a lot of people, even old time activists. In the video, Raymond Wood is seen being promoted for his role in that plot.
The happy ending to the plot was written by a rookie policeman who had been on the force only 8 months when he infiltrated the extremist group. His work led police to a quiet New York residential area where the dynamite had been hidden. Another arrested was Khalil Saeed, who police say went to the Statue of Liberty to buy a model and further the plot with the fourth conspirator, Walter Bowe. The hero cop, his face hidden for future undercover work, is promoted on the spot to the rank of detective. A happy climax to a bizarre story.
The arrests were carried out on February 16th, just days before Malcolm X was assassinated. And this is very significant, Reggie Wood, as you know, this so-called Statue of Liberty plot, because these men who were arrested were the security team of Malcolm X, meaning he wouldn't have them there February 21st, a few days later when he was assassinated.
That's correct. That's correct. As we were doing our research, my research assistant, Lizette Salato, really helped me put the pieces together. We whiteboarded
everything that Ray said and attempted to connect it to facts that the FBI had released and that historians had pulled out. And we worked closely with some historians to try to corroborate the information that was there. And once we were able to do that, we were able to present that information to Mr. Crump and show that this was a legitimate situation that needed to be brought to light.
Now, in the 2015 article in The Guardian, historian Garrett Felber reveals notes written by the late Japanese-American activist Yuri Kochiyama. At a meeting held in 1965, she identified Ray Wood to be at the scene of Malcolm X's assassination. She wrote, quote, Ray Woods, she wrote with an S, Ray Woods is said to have been seen also running out of Audubon, was one of two picked up by police, was the second person running out, Yuri wrote. This appears to substantiate some of the accounts of a second man taken into police custody after the assassination. I spent many hours with Yuri Kochiyama talking to her at an assisted living facility at the end of her life in Oakland before she died. Can you talk about what happened at the assassination? Because Yuri is right here. She was very close to Malcolm X, up on the stage with him. As well at the end, as after he was shot, that your cousin ran out and was taken away by police.
Yes. What Ray basically explained to me was that once he saw what was going down and he realized what had actually happened after spending time with Mr. Saeed and Mr. Bo, he was there and he reminisced or thought about the situation with him coming into the Audubon without being checked. He thought about the fact that those guys were in prison as we spoke. And he decided he needed to get out of there. And as he was leaving, some individuals that knew him from his other undercover work, and he had been exposed somewhat from the bombing case, saw him and they attempted to grab him. As they were grabbing him, trying to restrain him, a police officer intervened and grabbed Ray and took him into the police car. And from there, they took him to the precinct and put him into a cell where he sat there for 3 to 4 hours, not knowing what was going on. The only information that he had was listening to the chatter on the radio while they were transporting him to the police station. And later that afternoon, the same two gentlemen that told him to go to the Audubon came and removed him from his cell and drove him back home and told him, quote, do not speak of this again or you will face similar consequences.
Did he know Gene Roberts, the other undercover officer, or at least one other that we know of who was there?
No, he did not. He did not know him. He did not know he was an undercover. He assumed he was part of Malcolm X's team.
So, Ben Crump, you ended the last segment where we want to talk at the end of this segment, and that is the issue of what evidence is out there that the police or the FBI is hiding and what you are calling for. It's interesting that last week a court ruled that the disciplinary records of New York police going back for years must be released. De Blasio said they're releasing them, the mayor of New York, not clear if they're being released at this moment. That's disciplinary records. And the police unions have been fighting this tooth and nail. What are you calling for in this case?
Well, Amy, thank you for covering this important matter as well. And to Reggie Wood, who has put forth this dying declaration letter from his cousin, Ray Wood, and documented all the corroborating evidence and the memoir that he and Lissette researched to show that everything in that letter is true. It is legitimate. And that's very important to help exonerate all those black people who were wrongfully convicted by Ray Wood's work, all those people who have been conspired against by the NYPD and the FBI, whether that be Walter Bow, Khalid Saeed, whether it be Thomas Johnson, who was picked up, who wasn't even at the Audubon Ballroom, but to ensure that Ray's cover would not be blown, was arrested and served almost 3 decades in prison for a crime of killing Malcolm X that they all knew he did not do. And also Tupac Shakur's mother, Fannie Shakur, part of the Panther 21, who Ray Wood testified against, saying that they tried to blow up New York monuments. And therefore, quite literally, she was in prison when she had her prince, Tupac Shakur, because of NYPD and the FBI were conspiring to wrongfully convict them. And as Ray Wood said in his letter, their job was to discredit civil rights organizations and black leaders. And that's why we're calling for a Malcolm X commission to be convened by the United States Congress. So his daughters, but also the people who was affected by these felonious actions of NYPD and the FBI to target black people can be exposed, because, Amy, the past is prologue. As Reggie Wood and I have often taught, the same way they targeted Malcolm X for saying that black people deserve equality by any means necessary, they are targeting young Black Lives Matter activists today, labeling them as black identity extremists. And so we need to have our federal government be held to account for trying to stop black people from exercising their First Amendment rights, but more importantly, for being able to declare that Black Lives Matter over and over again.
Benjamin Crump, we want to thank you for being with us, civil rights attorney speaking to us from New Orleans. And thank you to Reggie Wood, author of the new book, The Ray Wood Story, Confessions of a Black NYPD Cop and the Assassination of Malcolm X. Reggie Wood speaking to us from Tampa, Florida. When we come back, we'll get reaction from Ilyasa Shabazz, one of the 6 daughters of Malcolm X, who herself has just written a young adult novel based on her father's time in jail. Stay with us.
Those of Malcolm X, white men got vexed. They didn't want to see black men progress. And all along the way, black men have strayed, searching to find the way.
Malcolm X by Dennis Brown. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The Quarantine Report. I'm Amy Goodman. To talk more about the assassination of Malcolm X, we're joined by his daughter, Ilyasa Shabazz. She joined Reggie Wood on Saturday when he released the deathbed confession of his cousin, the late undercover police officer Raymond Wood, who described being part of a police and FBI conspiracy that targeted Malcolm X, was there at his assassination. Ilyasa Shabazz is professor at John Jay College of Criminal Justice in New York, a community organizer, motivational speaker, activist, and award-winning author. Ilyasa Shabazz and Tiffany Jackson have just co-written a new book for young adults titled The Awakening of Malcolm X. Before we go back in time to the book and Malcolm X's history, Ilyasa, can you respond to this bombshell deathbed revelation that Reggie just shared with us?
Wow. You know, I think it's deplorable, but I think that it's good that he came forward with this letter, because many people just did not understand how
intricately involved. Our people in powerful positions were to infiltrate organizations that set out to improve society.
I mean, true that Reggie Wood, Raymond Wood, not only infiltrated the Malcolm X's organization, but CORE, the Panther 21, all these different groupings. Now, you have dealt with this slow drip of revelations over the decades. I mean, you are Malcolm X's daughter. Can you talk about the effect on your family and what you're calling for now? Do you join Ben Crump in calling for a reopening of the investigation of your father's assassination?
Absolutely. We want the truth uncovered. And if it's the Manhattan District Attorney, the United States Congress, We would like them to do a thorough investigation on the assassination of our father, Malcolm X. You know, it was quite challenging, you can imagine, for my mother, who was a young woman, pregnant with my youngest sisters, the twins, had four babies, to walk into the Audubon excited to see her husband because their home had been firebombed just a week prior on the evening of Valentine's Day. And for her to be able to go and see her husband with her family, she must have walked in to that Audubon Sunday afternoon really excited and left shattered. And when I discovered this letter, when I discovered this Reggie Wood with this information, you know, I thought of my mother. I thought of my father, just a young man. All he wanted was for America to live up to her promise of liberty and justice for all. And he worked quite diligently for 12 years looking for solutions to this ongoing problem. And he provided the biggest critique of America. And I'm happy that the truth can finally be uncovered. And so whatever it takes, I and my five sisters are supportive of that effort.
You were there 56 years ago, horrifyingly. How old were you? 2 years old in the Audubon Ballroom where you returned this past weekend. I mean, of course, you've been there many times. It's now the Shabazz Center. 56 years ago when he was gunned down, you were there with your sisters and mom.
That's right. That's right. And, you know, again, I always go back to my mother. It had to have been just so difficult for her and how she safeguarded her husband's legacy. Because, look, what most people are discovering now is that all of what they learned about Malcolm X, it was absolutely inaccurate. This past summer, while young people were politicized because of this global pandemic, because of being forced to watch this horrific death of George Floyd, going out into the streets, protesting 50 states in this country, 18 countries abroad. And, you know, we discovered that my father was quoted 53.7 thousand times per hour in social media. And this is the clearest indication that people wanted to know the truth about Malcolm X. They knew that Malcolm spoke truth and that he provided strategies and tactics that they could employ to meet these socioeconomic challenges head on. And so I take my hat off to these young people for being diligent as well.
I wanted to go to an excerpt of a speech your dad gave at the Audubon Ballroom in 64, about half a year before he was assassinated there. It's called "By Any Means Necessary."
One of the first things that the independent African nations did was to form an organization called the Organization of African Unity. The purpose of our organization of Afro-American Unity, which has the same aim and objective, to fight whoever gets in our way. To bring about the complete independence of people of African descent here in the Western Western Hemisphere and first here in the United States, and bring about the freedom of these people by any means necessary.
That was Malcolm X months before he was assassinated. Ilyasa Shabazz, you have now written a book for young adults called The Awakening of Malcolm X, and it really focuses on his time in jail. Talk about why you chose this period and what do you think is so critical for young people to take from it?
Well, I wanted to first make sure that I showed that Malcolm didn't go to jail and miraculously become Malcolm X, that his parents instilled specific values. And it speaks to all of the smart, forward-thinking adults that, you know, we have to provide guidance for our children. They need an education curriculum that teaches the truth. We can't sit back and expect someone else to do these things for us. If our young people understood that, say, in world history classes, as I teach my students, that Africa is the cradle of the most advanced, thriving civilization ever to exist in mankind, and if they also learned about the impressive kingdoms of Benin, Fudajello, Mali, Egypt, to the same degree that we teach them of ancient Greece and Rome, then we might better appreciate the beauty and magnificence of non-white civilizations in Africa, Asia, and Latin America. And we would have the opportunity to teach our children love, respect, instead of instilling these values of hate and discrimination. Rather, love and respect for ourselves and then for humanity. You know, I think all of these things are extremely important.
Write the book in the first person. What was it like to inhabit your father's perspective in this way?
Well, talking about the values that were instilled in him by his parents, and Malcolm running from himself, running from his identity, running from the fact that his father was lynched. His father was the president of the chapter president of an organization that was commanded by millions of followers in the 1920s, that he purchased land that was then reserved for whites only. And, you know, the KKK lynched him. They targeted his family. His mother, who was the recording secretary, instilling values of compassion, human compassion, literary, all these things that we see in Malcolm later in his life, was put into an institution. The family was separated. The land was taken. And so when Malcolm finds himself in jail, we find that Malcolm is still smart. He ends up being a star debater on the debate team. The prison debated against Ivy League schools, Harvard, MIT, Boston University, and Malcolm debated about about capital punishment. And so we see his compassion, we see his wit, we see his ability to inform and engage others. And so, you know, what we find is that Malcolm studied the dictionary not so that he could learn how to read and write, but he studied the dictionary so he could learn the etymology, the root words, so he could be his best. And when we look at today, the criminal justice system, we know that there are over 3 million people behind bars, that the U.S. spent in 2012 $80 billion taxpayer dollars on correction facilities, not education, not after-school programs. And so the incarcerated population has increased by 700%, and we wanted to focus on the humanity of these people behind bars.
And, of course, you dedicate the book to the incarcerated. Ilyasa Shabazz, I want to thank you so much for being with us. The book is called The Awakening of Malcolm X. I'm Amy Goodman. Wear a mask. Stay safe.